Anyone heard any good rumors lately? Any really juicy gossip? Any good stuff? There was an individual in the church when we lived in Texas who from time to time would call me and update me on all of the gossip and all of the rumors that she had been able to kind of compile. And it always surprised me that she would call me with that, because, you know, I figured, well, you're not going to call the minister. You know, you might call your friend or your buddy or something, but, you know, you don't call the minister and then unload the gossip on him. It just seemed strange. She was very well connected. She had managed to put her contacts in all the right places so that as things came up, she had the information she needed, and then she would pass it on to me. And finally, I grew a little bit weary of that, and so the next time she called me and I recognized her voice on the phone, I said, well, Mrs. So-and-so, what juicy tidbits do you have for me today? Now, maybe that wasn't the kindest way to shut that system down, but you know, after that, I just never heard any more rumors and gossip on that line. It was an incredible thing. Like I say, maybe it wasn't my best form, but usually if Michelle's around when I respond like that, she goes, Mark, you know, and kind of pulls me back a little bit, but it's amazing. If you go back and think about United Church of God as it formed, there really was a period of time there where we were armed. Now, I've addressed in the past what we were armed with. We were armed with our weapons of protection, which was to read between the lines and impute what the motives would be in a circumstance and look behind the scenes and analyze and kind of justify and measure. And those were things we armed ourselves with in the midst of that controversy that we were in. But the time came and we had to honestly disarm and put our weapons down and in that sense go on with our lives and begin to focus more internally than that. Henry Van Dyke was a writer, died back in 1933. Not an individual, honestly, I know much about, but I do know something that he said that I think is significant here. He said, there are two good rules which ought to be written on every heart. Never believe anything bad about anybody unless you positively know that it is true, and never tell even that unless you feel that it is absolutely necessary and that God is listening while you tell it. Obviously, God is listening, but again, let me just go through that again because he put it so strongly, and yet I think it is true. He says, never believe anything bad about anybody unless you positively know that it is true, and never tell even that unless you feel that it is absolutely necessary and that God is listening while you tell it. Alcoholics Anonymous has a concept. It's called working on your own program. A friend of mine went through that 12-step program, and after she went through the program, I asked her, what was the most fundamental lesson that she learned? What was it in that program, in that sense, that had the biggest impact on her life? And she said, in fact, that's indeed what it was, to work your own program. To stop trying to control people and things all around you and begin to start to simply focus on and directing yourselves. And she said, out of all the program, the thing that really impacted her the most was that. They use, and you've heard it used as well, I'm sure, as I have, the Serenity Prayer sometimes in that context. And the Serenity Prayer goes, if I wrote it down correctly, it says, God grant me the serenity to accept the things that I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. In that sense, it's a statement that says, let's do what we can, let's not do what we can't, and let's have the wisdom to know the decision to make in that process. And I think that's critical and fundamental to our life. Matthew 7 is a scripture that talks about self-focus, about working your own program, and it puts it in the context with another scripture that we never really quote together with Matthew 7. We separate them like as if they have two separate meanings, but they're actually recorded here together. Matthew 7, verse 1, judge not that you be not judged. For with what judgment you judge, you will be judged. With the same measure you use, it will be measured back to you. Why do you look at the speck in your brother's eye, but do not consider the plank in your own eye? How can you say to your brother, let me remove the speck out of your eye, and look, a plank is in your own eye? Hypocrite! First, remove the plank from your own eye, and then you'll see clearly to remove the speck out of your brother's eye. Now, I think we can understand that in concept, but you go on now to verse number 6. We don't read verse number 6 in the context with the speck and the plank. We separate it out as if it means something totally different. We say, do not give what is holy to the dogs, nor cast your pearls before swine, lest they trample them under their feet and turn and tear you to pieces. When we talk about not casting the pearls, our pearls before swine, we talk about not taking those things that are precious that God has given us and just giving them to someone who won't appreciate them. We don't put it in the context, in that sense, of not taking out the speck because you have a plank in your own eye. And the point there being simply that do not, indeed, give to someone else. Do not apply what you know to someone else because it won't necessarily work. Don't take what you have to apply to yourself. Do not take the knowledge you have and try to fix those around you with it. And it simply doesn't work. My father was a controller in the sense that it's used socially. And my brothers generally were too, and somehow out of that environment, I'm probably the only one who came out of that family who wasn't. I tell a joke. Our family, our boys, we were all boys, and my dad, were kind of controllers in that sense. You know, when a person becomes a controller, it's a way of stabilizing your life. It's a way of trying to make everything work around you so that, in that sense, so that you have confidence and security in the outcome. It's a way to try to control matters around you. An incident that happened at the beginning of our marriage, Michelle was washing a shower curtain that had some mold or something on it. And I walked in and saw her there, so I stopped and, you know, out of the goodness of my husbandly heart, I told her how to wash that shower curtain the best. You know, how to get the mold off and, you know, what you could do to dry it all out. I figured I was just being very, very helpful. And well, finally, about 2 years ago, I said, honey, would you please find another example so that when we discuss these things, at least we could have a fresh discussion? Do you want to know what the impact was of controlling her life in that way? You know, she felt in that sense, you know, that I had interceded and tried to, you know, control her life in a way that really was in unnecessary, inappropriate. And it burned a little bit of a issue into her mind. Well, she stopped using that example. Now she just pulls out of her hat other examples and we can discuss kind of new things. Controlling is a remarkable thing. It's so built into parts of our personalities and our nature. Because we're going to camp and because I'm working with rock climbing, I've been getting my gear and things ready and trying to get in shape. And I've been talking to Megan and Derek, and they're kind of excited too, and they want to go. So I took them down this last week and took them down to Mountain Gear, and they have an indoor wall, and I hooked them up on a rope and a harness and let them go to it on the easier climb on that wall. I found it very, very hard as they were climbing up, and I'm belaying them, and they're going up the wall slowly and feeling their way, something the first time they've ever done it in their life. I found it very hard not to say, in fact, I didn't succeed very well, but I found it very hard not to say, put your left foot on that rock and your right foot on that rock and your right hand on this rock. And I wanted to walk them up the wall myself. I wanted to place their hands. I wanted them to be successful. I wanted them to reach the top. And I wanted it so bad that I was almost willing and desirous of doing it for them. But that's not how we accomplish our tasks profitably in this life. And I had to constantly, mentally tell myself, no, let them find the hold themselves. And then if they call for help or if they need help or if they're stuck, then assist them. I'm there to assist them, but I'm not there to direct their steps. When the instructor that I went out with the week before was working with me, he just simply sent me up the wall and basically said, you know, climb it or drop. And I dropped. Of course, he had the rope on me, so it wasn't like there was a risk, but In that sense, he wanted me to go see what it is that I could do and what I could not, and then he went up after me and showed me how to traverse that particular area. And I watched him, and I'll try to do it the way he did the next time. But, you know, it's a funny thing when God in his Bible talks about looking to yourself in a way in terms of personal responsibility, working your own program. There's a very real issue there, very important issue there. You can control people in different ways. You can control people with emotions, not just by commands or orders or directives. You can control people with your emotions. Generally, when a person is pouting, it's a means of control, an effort at control. It's a way of doing battle, to try to get your way and control people where you don't necessarily have authority or power to control them. So it's a more of a subtle way of trying to assert control. And there's different ways, indeed, in which we do that. Sometimes I've counseled couples in the church, and one or the other, usually the woman, was withholding sex from her husband, and that was a means of control because, boy, she could really get to the bottom line quickly on those issues. And I've seen that happen at times. Sometimes it was done openly and overtly, and other times it was done unconsciously in ways where, well, we just, no, I'm sorry, I don't feel good, but I just happen to be stressed. And, well, the reason I'm stressed and what you could do to solve my problem, it goes on. Anorexia is a means of control. It's a control freak, as the term is used in the vernacular. When life is out of control in other areas, maybe your family, maybe your job, maybe your finances, maybe who knows what it will be, when these things are out of control and you find something that you can begin to control absolutely, and food becomes it. And pretty soon you begin to control the portions and the amounts, and you begin to control exactly what you eat and when and how, and you start to exert this control over the body. It's a control issue. And it's one place that a person will find sometimes. People do it sometimes with exercise. There's a lot of different circumstances. Ask yourself, is that the way God works with us? Is God, as we would use the vernacular term, a control freak? Now, he's got all power, all authority, and yet does he not let us make a mistake without intervening and going, zap, don't do it again? Does he not allow us, does he not back off and give us room and latitude to make decision and try and test and get your fingers burned and pull back and then try again? Does God not do that for us? When husbands and wives, when children, when friends, employers, employees, whatever the relationship is, begin to exert an improper type of control, it is not a godly choice. It is not the way God would have it to be. God works with us in a very remarkably personal way, but he works with us to change ourselves rather than to try to change those around us, to take personal responsibility and to get our attention, not to get our attention to go fix someone else. That's related to judging. That's related to the way that we deal with each other, to taking that plank out of our own eye. Exodus 6, verse number 1, here we have Israel and Egypt. Notice what the purpose of all the plagues and all the trials and all the tests that here are going to be. Exodus 6 says, then the Lord said to Moses, now you shall see what I will do to Pharaoh, for with a strong hand he will let them go, with a strong hand he will drive them out of the land. God spoke to Moses and said to him, I am the Lord. And he says, look, I appeared to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And he's reminding Moses of who he is and what he has done. He talks about the covenant he had established and how Moses is about to be a recipient in Israel of the promises of that covenant. He says, I've also heard the groaning of the children of Israel whom the Egyptians kept in bondage, or keep in bondage, and I've remembered my covenant. Therefore, tell the children of Israel, I am the Lord. I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. I'll rescue you from your bondage. I'll redeem you with an outstretched arm and with great judgments. He says, tell the children of Israel, I am the Lord, and I will take you as my people, and I will be your God, and then you will know that I am the Lord, your God, who brings you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. You're going to go through all this test and trial. You're going to go through all these things that you're going to see. It will be very, very dramatic. And then you're going to know that I am God. He didn't say, then I can use you to punish Pharaoh. Then I can use you to correct each other. He says, then you will know that I am your God. A very personal, in that sense, approach. Deuteronomy 29. This is a theme that goes throughout the entire Bible. I simply pulled a couple of verses to illustrate it. Deuteronomy 29 is after the blessings and cursings have been explained and pronounced. It's before Israel is about to enter now the promised land. 40 years have passed by. And again, it says, these are the words of the covenant which the Lord commanded Moses to make with the children of Israel in the land of Moab, besides the covenant which he made with them in Horeb. And it goes down through and it mentions Egypt and all that they walked out of and how they've led, verse 5, 40 years in the wilderness. And their clothes didn't wear out and their sandals didn't wear out. And they didn't eat bread or drink wine or similar drink. He said in verse 6, that you may know that I am the Lord your God. Your sandals didn't wear out. Your clothes didn't wear out. I fed you with manna. I miraculously intervened on your behalf so that you personally would know that I am God. So that you would look to me directly and know that I am working indeed with you. Ezekiel 6. Figured if I could skip far enough through the Bible, and if you look through your own concordance or Bible program, you're going to see that particular phrase or variations of it scattered through the whole Bible, where God repeatedly makes that statement. But Ezekiel 6, verse number 1. Now the word of the Lord came to me, said, Son of man, set your face toward the mountains of Israel and prophesy against them. Down in 6. In all your dwelling places the cities shall be laid waste, the high places desolate, altars laid waste, idols broken, incense altars cut down, and your works abolished. The slain shall fall in your midst, and you shall know that I am the Lord. Even in punishment, God's purpose is to point himself out to us and to direct us to him, back to him. Verse number 9. Those of you who escape will remember me among the nations where they're carried captive because you played the harlot with their idols, and they'll loathe themselves for the evils which they have committed in all their abominations, and they shall know that I am the Lord and that I have not said in vain that I would bring this calamity upon them. Verse number 12. He who is far off shall die by the pestilence. He who is near shall fall by the sword. He who remains and is besieged shall die in the famine. Thus I'll spend my fury on them. Then you shall know that I am the Lord when their slain men are among their idols around the altars on every high hill, on every mountaintop. So God was telling Israel in that sense that there would be blessings, there would be curses, that he would work with them. And what was the purpose? The purpose was to direct the people to God so that they would have, in that sense, a personal trust and faith and belief and a relationship with God in that way. How is it that we then come to believe God? What is it that made us convicted in our lives that the way we were living our lives had to change? You know, I was doing some things when God began to call me that some of my friends didn't even approve of. And there were times when my friend said, if you do that, I will not be there. And I figured, well, then I guess you won't be there. And one of my friends one time told me we were getting ready to go hunting, and he says, if you do that, I will not hunt with you. I said, well, I guess it's going to be a quiet hunt. My friends told me not to do certain things. Never changed my mind. It never changed my value system that I had adopted. I simply did those things that I wanted and chose to do. But when God began to open my mind and show me that he was the Lord God, that he was the one who was instructing me to begin to change and stop doing these things, then I began to indeed change. I didn't change because someone demanded that I change. I changed because God opened my mind to show me that he was God. And that's what he wanted, above all else. We don't basically change because our husband or our wife or our children demands it, do we? We don't basically change because a friend or an acquaintance demands it. We change because we come to believe that God exists and that he cares about what we do. and that he gives us instruction in that regard. We come to change because of a personal conviction. Can you understand why throughout the Bible, and again, if you did your own study, you would find over and over and over again, God says, this is going to happen. Then you're going to know that I am God. I'm really here. I remember one time going home from college, and I don't know how it came up, but my dad somehow or other asked about finances, and I mentioned tithing in the church. Money was very important to my father, incredibly important. He was an honest man, but it was important. And he just said, you can't do that. That's not possible. You can't tithe. It won't work. I said, Dad, you don't understand. God is real. This is not a concept. This isn't a bedtime story. This is a God who is a real God, and it is His command, and He blesses us as well. And yes, it does work. But my dad never knew that God was real. Now, he believed there was a God. And he had been to church as a child. And he would have never denied that. And he sent us children to church as we grew up, made us walk. But he sent us. And we went to church, and I grew up in fellowships and church schools and Bible schools and summer church activities and off on retreats. I did those things. He required all of us children to do so, even though we had to go do it on our own. But my dad never knew that God was real and that there was a relationship there that would be intimately and personally maintained. And that has a big impact on how we respond to God and how we respond to each other. We need to understand that what God gives us to do is for us to do because He has opened our mind to do so. It doesn't mean that everybody shouldn't do it, but it doesn't mean that we can make them do it. Or even consider that we should have responsibility to see that they try to do it. Psalm 23. I don't know if this gets read much in church. Everybody ought to know it anyway. But I don't know if we read this much. But look at the context here in terms of personal relationship with God and God directing here David in an intimate, personal way. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me to lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside the still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in the paths of righteousness for His name's sake. And yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for You are with me. Your rod and Your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup runs over. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. David isn't saying that God made everyone to lie down in green pastures or didn't lead everyone beside still waters. He didn't restore everyone's soul. He did not lead everyone in the paths of righteousness for His name's sake. It's simply not our responsibility to do so. To be willing and able and a vessel in which God can use, yes, we should do that. But God works through our lives, through circumstances in our lives, in ways to cause us individually to change as compared to try to change others around us. As I said, God worked with us in a very personal way. I remember when I first began to kind of seek out to God, it was my first contact with someone in the church. And so I had started to read the very early pieces of literature that I had been exposed to. I had begun to ask some of those very early questions. And yet I still only half believed that God really and truly was there. Now, I guess I believed it, but I had no proof yet. And I was living in Tennessee at the time, and I had driven down to Georgia. I think I'd gone down to Atlanta, was coming back. I had a 67 Camaro, got 15 miles to the gallon. And I'd never really been in that part of the country before, and I was running out of fuel, driving back, and about 90 miles from home, through the mountains and hill country there. And I just figured that I'd stop as I went, and I'd get some gas and fill up and finish the trip home, and there wasn't anywhere to stop. See, They didn't used to have quick stops everywhere. Remember? They didn't used to have hamburger joints everywhere. They didn't have these convenience stores. Those things just didn't exist once upon a time. And so I was driving around, and I'd go through these little towns, and the whole place would be shut down, black, dark, nothing, no store, no pump, no gas. It was very late, into the a.m. hours now of the morning, and I had no gas, and I was very close to empty, and I was a good portion of 90 miles from home. And here I am, I only half believe that God was real, someone that you could actually connect with. I only half believed it, but he was beginning to draw me, and so I kind of decided that I'd speak to the half that I was more sure of. And I said, help me get home. I don't want to be stuck out here on the hills and the mountains at night. I want to get home tonight. And my needle on the gas tank, where it measures, actually got, you know, where it stops. You ever done that? The needle quits moving. It just locks there. Sometimes there's a little pin to rest against. Sometimes it just goes down to runs out of room. The needle stopped. It was gone, and I drove, and I drove, and I kept looking at that gas, and, you know, fretting in my mind, and drove and drove, and I drove all the way home. Parked the car in the garage, 15 miles a gallon on a dead needle, and I can't prove to you God did that, but I believe he did. I personally believe that God, in his effort to say, and now you will know that I am the Lord, in his effort to show me that as he began to call me, that he actually, whatever he did, you know, I don't know if he was pushing from behind or pulling from the front or you know, pouring it in as I went. I don't know what he did. But I made it home at a time when I was first reaching out in a very small way to him. And I believe that was God helping me in that very small way. It wasn't to do it to anyone else. It didn't prove anything to anyone else. It only proved something to me, that God was there. Now, I guess he only gives you one of those in this life, because I've since run out of gas many times. Sometimes God works with us in a way that makes us stop then. If you can understand that he works with us very intimately and personally, then sometimes he'll take those very intimate and personal events in our lives and try to get us to say, look, now let's start worrying about the plank now, okay? Forget about that speck. Let's get back on the plank, and I want to show you how. Friends of ours, a few years ago, attended the feast with us. I've worked with First Aid at the feast for years. I don't know how many, 8, 9 years maybe at the feast. I've worked with First Aid, and I'm working with it again this year. And so we always have a row of seats for First Aid staff to sit on, plus from me and my family or whoever's with us. And so there's always a row, and each chair has a big First Aid reserved or something on it, reserve signs, and they stay open. And I tell the usher who's on duty that day, and they know how many seats I need and how many can be released, if so, at the end. And so the friends who were with us at the feast were sitting in the middle of the chairs, and we had some of our gear out, and a woman came by and was kind of looking for a seat. Of course, these are so open and tempting. And they're kind of off to the back in the corner, but they were so convenient. And she turned to our friend, and said, are these seats taken? He said, well, they're reserved for the First Aid staff, but if you'll ask the usher, he can tell you if they're going to be released. She looked around. Usher was down there a ways. She fidgeted a bit. Finally, she sat down. And it really irritated our friend, because she hadn't obeyed the law. And then after a while, he just couldn't stand it, and he said, what did the usher say? And she says, I didn't ask. And that made him mad. And so then he stewed and fussed on that through the sermon, and you know how you struggle with somebody speaking. You say, I need to listen to this, but this is controversy is now going on in your mind. And he actually left church that day with a pretty bad attitude about this whole thing and how abusive this person was and self-serving and didn't really obey the rules and just on and on it went. You know, you build this up in your mind and you feed on it. And then he went home and he was really struggling with it. And he prayed about it and he realized he got to get rid of this. This is unprofitable. This is not what we're here for. So wrestled with this thing and put it away. Came back to church and he said, well, I'll tell you what, I'm not even going to sit in First Aid today. I'm going to get rid of this one. You know, a couple thousand people in the auditorium, goes completely across the auditorium, finds himself a seat way over there in the corner, a couple of extra seats around. He's sitting there waiting for services. And this woman walks up to the row where he's sitting in and said, are these seats taken? And he looks up, and it was the same person. Now, all the way across. He's hiding, you know. He's all the way across the auditorium, trying to get away from this woman. You know, and she comes to the exact row at the exact next service the next day and says, "Are these seats taken?" And, of course, because he'd prayed about it and struggled with it and was sincere in what he was trying to do, he got up and said, no, these are open. And he talked and said, found out that she was a very nice person, very pleasant person. And it was one of those things that, don't you think, again, that we all believe in coincidences, but don't you think it's just possible that God was trying to work with him to teach him something, and the way he did it was to allow him to go through this little test? And wouldn't the lesson be something like, come on, buddy, get the plank out of the old eye and leave these people alone. It's not your problem. You're not in charge of the auditorium seating. You're not in charge of whether this person is having a problem or not. You're in charge of you, and you're okay. I think maybe that's possibly what God was doing. It just seems to me that God has worked that way many times in my own life. We need to be working our own program. Now, when I say that, I'm not throwing out a sense of community that we need to have. I'm addressing a principle. We are a community. We're a church community, and that's very, very important. But we're not a community that needs to be solving each other's problems by our own choice. Luke 12, verse 35. Listening to a tape today as I was driving, Roy Holiday was given a split sermon, and he was actually quoting from this very verse, and it's one I had put in my own sermon, so I figured I'd listen to that and see what it meant so that I could finish my sermon as well. I was just going to play his tape right here, but I decided not to do that. Luke 12, verse 35 says, "Let your waist be girded, your lamps burning, and you yourselves, be like men who wait for their master. And when he returns from the wedding, when he comes and knocks, you may open to him immediately. Blessed are those servants whom the master, when he comes, will find watching. Assuredly, I say to you that he will gird himself and have them sit down to eat, and he'll come and serve them." He just said, make sure you're doing your job, your part, fulfilling your responsibilities. Don't be too worried about the fact that maybe somebody else isn't on cue yet. Make sure that you are. He says, "And if he should come in the second watch or the third watch, and find them so, blessed are those servants." What's interesting, again, it's an analogy, but the analogy is that there are different watches, and that Christ doesn't come on the first watch in this case. There's a watch where people are watching and waiting for Christ, and then their watch is finished, and they have to fulfill their obligation in the process, but Christ never came. So the next watch comes on and watches and waits for Christ, and he didn't come then either. And there's a succession of watches, and Christ has yet to come. And I think it's interesting because I think that's very much part of what we face as well. But know this, if the master of the house had known what hour the thief would come, he would have watched and not allowed his house to be broken into. Therefore, you also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect. Now, we have in the church over the years developed a culture, a little subculture of watching world events. You watch to see if the King of the North has formed in Europe. We watch to see if the King of the South is formed in the Middle Eastern areas or in the South. We watch to see the fulfillment of the European market that is formed and the trade and the combination of power. We look at the military. There's a lot of things we begin to watch for prophecy purposes because we says, watch therefore, watch you always and be ready. And so we begin to focus on the world events as if we're watching the events, and then when we see it happen, then we're going to hurry up and be ready because we'll be warned. I don't believe that's the point. I believe the point is for us to be watching that we be ready at all times, whether it be the first or the second or the third watch. We have to watch the first watch even when world events are not ready. Even when world events are 2-3 watches away, we're still having to watch. And I think sometimes, and I've known people who focused so much on watching that it just seemed like that consumed them. But it's watching everything else. It's watching the events. It's watching circumstances. But what God would have us to watch the most is right here at home. That's the first priority. Luke 12:41. Peter said to him, "Lord, do you speak this parable only to us or to all people?" And the Lord said, who then is that faithful and wise steward who his master will make ruler over his household to give them their portion of food in due season? Now he goes on and describes here the fact that that wise steward is the one who is ready no matter what. Now what's the question Peter asked? Peter says, are you talking to me? Or are you talking to everybody? And Christ turned right around and said, look, if the shoe fits, wear it. If you need to be ready, then get ready. But he basically said, you, Peter, I'm talking to you. Or I'm talking to you, my disciples. It applies to anybody in that sense, to anyone God is indeed calling. But he said, I'm talking to you. The issue here is stewardship, verse number 42. Who then is that faithful and wise steward whom his master will make ruler over his household to give them their portion of food in due season? Those who are willing to do what they have been given to do. We're rewarded according to what we have done. We are not rewarded or given blessing in comparison to anyone else. When I was in college in Oregon, before I went to Ambassador College, I took chemistry. And it really frustrated me because that's when the calculator was first invented, back before they had convenience stores and stop-and-goes and instant pizza. They had just invented the calculator, and they cost $125 a piece. And only a couple of kids in chemistry actually could afford them, and the rest of us couldn't. We still had our slide rules, and I wasn't very good with a slide rule, so I was crunching along very slowly, and these calculator people, who were the rich kids, were going bang, 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 shh, and then, of course, chemistry was all calculations, and they were blowing the curve on the test. They'd move the top of the curve 20 points because they could run those calculations so fast, and the rest of us, unless you were really good on a slide rule. If you were good, you could still be fast. I wasn't. I'm not even good on a calculator yet. But they were blowing the curve, and it made the rest of us look bad because it opened up that gap. You know, God isn't grading on a curve. We don't have to worry about if somebody else succeeded or somebody else failed. We don't have to worry about if somebody else made gain or lost, or whether they were acclaimed or put down. It does not affect our relationship to God and our perspective. So we don't have to worry about who got the calculators and who didn't, and who's clunking along and who's not, because we only have to, in that sense, worry about ourselves. It just simply doesn't matter what the other issues are. That's what our Christian life is all about. It's not about what others do, it's about what we do. Does anybody else really know what we're thinking? I mean, in this flesh, not really. I mean, they might see the fruit of our lives, and they might have a general impression, but do they really, really know our heart? Nobody really knows our hearts but God and hopefully our own selves. I say hopefully because I'm not sure everybody really stops and looks inside themselves in that clear sense of the way, but in this flesh, nobody else really knows ultimately and intimately and perfectly what our attitude and approach really is. As I said, we give an impression to each other, but only God knows our heart. Philippians 2 and verse number 5. Talks about the attitude of Jesus Christ. It says, let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus, who being in the form of God, didn't consider it robbery to be equal with God. And it goes through down to verse 11, and it talks about how Christ was humbled. At least down through verse 8, humbled himself, became obedient to the point of death. Therefore, verse 9, God has highly exalted him. Christ, for his responsibility, submitted himself and humbled himself, and therefore he was exalted, but he was exalted by God, not by himself. He did not exalt in that sense himself. Verse 12, therefore. Therefore means, in regard to this passage that we have just read, in regard to this material that I have just recorded in the book of Philippians, therefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed, not in my presence only, but now much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. You be responsible for the fact that you must be humbled and submissive as well to God, and let him exalt you. Just as Christ gave us the example, do not try to exalt yourself. Do not be worried about the fact that somebody else was exalted. Don't worry about the fact that maybe somebody else wasn't exalted. God says, I take responsibility for that. I'm working with you. It says, for it is God who works in you both to will and to do his good pleasure. Work your own program. Romans 14 talks about judgment. It says, who are you to judge another man's servant? God says, thank you very much. I'll be the judge. I'll do the sorting. 1 Corinthians 11, the scriptures we use with the Passover, says, you know, if we would simply judge ourselves, then we wouldn't have to be judged. If we would examine ourselves, that's what our Christian responsibility is. We need to be working our own program, brethren. We need to look inside our own hearts. We need to try to let go of the fact that we measure ourselves against others, against what they have received or not received, against what they should receive in our heart or our eye, and what they should not. We need to work our own program, judging and measuring ourselves. That's what God has called us to. He's called us to focus on our future and being committed to what we indeed do believe. Everything else will take care of itself. We have a work to do, and the best way to be about doing that work is to first be working on ourselves.